And good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. This is Chuck Horton from Double Cross Radio coming to you live on the UCY network, and we're broadcasting from the state of Jefferson, which is basically composed of the counties in Northern California and Southern Oregon that kind of align themselves along the border between Oregon and California. And on the California side and Oregon side, there's a few other counties that are trying to join in too. So it's a growing movement, and we're still behind that movement. It's people trying to be free or more free. Joined tonight, Drew's got a slight emergency. It's actually not a slight emergency. It's a pretty big emergency with his farm, and it's coming a fish die-off, some equipment failure. So he's not able to join us tonight. But we do have Colby Olson who's with us tonight. Colby, how's it going, Chuck? I'm having a good day. I'm a little bit bothered by some little sugar ants. They're driving me crazy. But after Drew told me what his problems were, I don't feel like the sugar ants are that big a deal. And we're going to have a special guest.
Sugar ants are bad this year.
Yeah. I'm going to get right into this because I think we have enough material for more than an hour's worth of stuff tonight, so I don't want to waste time just gabbing here. We're going to be joined tonight by a special guest, Dennis Linthicum. He is a Klamath County Commissioner. And Klamath County is the county just to the east of Jackson County where we're located. And he's a former candidate to represent the 2nd Congressional District of Oregon. He is a graduate of UCLA with a bachelor's degree in economics, and he has a master's degree of arts from Biola, and he joins us for tonight's special broadcast. And he's the reason why we're having this program tonight, because of something he told to me in the Costco parking lot. Dennis, welcome to the show again.
Good evening, Chuck. It's good to hear that introduction because of a conversation we had in the Costco parking lot. And that's what's so cool about having the freedom to associate and converse and whatever, is we get to share ideas and talk about things, and then we get to take those thoughts and how those prosper and grow in our own mind and share it with other listeners. So it's a fabulous time to get together, and I'm glad. I was thinking for a minute you were going to call me a sugar ant or something, and I thought that wasn't good.
Well, no, I'm ADD a little bit, not real serious, but I'm trying to read today, and out of the corner of my eye, I see these little ants running across my desk all day long, and it's just been driving me crazy. It's distraction. I'm very prone to distraction. I finally had to go out and sit in a chair if I was going to get any reading done, so there's a lot of good information that I'd read previously, but I wanted to make sure I could find the stuff to be relevant to what we want to talk about tonight. Now, I'm going to clue everybody else in as to what our discussion was about it. Met Dennis several times when he's on the campaign trail, and unfortunately came in second place. But that's
actually what your listeners would be interested in hearing this, because this is part of the problem we face in the United States today in the loss of our liberty. I raised $29,000 and I came in second place to the guy who came in first, who raised $2.5 million, and he's been an incumbent for 16 years. So you can see how out of balance it is to bring a new guy in, have him introduce these ideas which are very libertarian and focused on individual freedom, personal responsibility, and self-governance, and have the other guy, because of 16 years incumbency, raise money out the gazoo and just be able to, you know, slam dunk the game. So it's
a
fortunate situation.
You're too much of a gentleman to say this, so I'm going to say it. Most of that money came from outside the state of Oregon, and for sure outside the 2nd Congressional District. And so he isn't representing us anymore. He's representing those people that are giving him that $2.5 million. And that's very apparent to me in watching the bills that he co-sponsors in Congress. So, okay, but let's on to more positive things. Get on to them. Ran into Dennis at the Freedom Fest in Las Vegas, which I've talked about on the show a couple times in the recent weeks. And we kind of conspired to do a little bit of, I guess, kind of share our experiences there, kind of share the cost of the reproduction of some of the shows that we didn't get to go, because sometimes there's conflicts. There's two or three different topics being discussed at different breakout sessions. You can't go to all of them. You can only pick one, and so you miss out on the other ones that were really good. And I'm finding that there's a lot of real interesting things to listen to. I listened to one on health by Mary Rupert the other day. It was just awesome, and I had missed that, and I was really kicking myself because that was something I was really interested in. I would have liked to have gone to it. Anyway, he had some stuff to drop off to me, and he was in town, and so we met at the Costco parking lot because that was convenient for both of us. And while he was there, he just brought up this thing. He had to get going, so he couldn't really get into this discussion very much, but just said, you know, America is different from every other place on Earth, because America is an idea more than it's a place. And I just kind of was thinking about that, and I said, well, I guess so, yeah. And then he started to go and explain for more. I'm going to let you explain it, because I think I will just fumble it up a little bit, so kind of get into this a little bit more and explain to people what this means. So, Dennis, go ahead.
You bet. The interesting thing, and I'm not the genius who thought of this. It's been thought of before, but I think it's so poignant. Everybody ought to just spend some time wondering about it. If you or I moved to France, would we ever become, quote, a Frenchman? And even, you know, aside from our language skills and whatever, even if you, you know, always studied French and you knew the language and stuff, if you moved to France after 40 years or after 12 years or after 5 years, would you be considered, quote, a Frenchman? Or would you be considered a German if you moved to Germany? Or would you be considered Japanese if you moved to Japan? How is it then that people from Poland and Latvia and Korea and Japan and China can move to America and become Americans? This is really a key distinction that we carry in the American heart and soul, is the self-evident truths that it's not a national allegiance, it's an allegiance to an idea, it's an allegiance to these inalienable rights. Among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And the very next sentence in our declaration is the most important sentence, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. So that's the reason our government exists, is to protect and secure these rights, to ensure these rights. government is not about getting, you know, goodies from, you know, from the cabinet or the government largesse or the treasury or your neighbor's pocket. Government is about securing your individual rights and your liberty. That's why someone can move here from Cambodia and after 5 years become an American citizen and claim, I am an American. And they can claim the rights of being an American, and they could never do that if they moved to France or Germany or Japan or Latvia. And so we occupy a really neat position in the world economy at large. We are different, and we need to stand up for the exceptional difference that makes America great.
Yeah, I was watching a video earlier that was kind of going over this same idea that a man from Turkey could move to France and it might be 10 generations before they'd be considered Frenchmen.
Right.
10
right.
generations, about 200 years, folks. And that's how it is in other countries. And as there's going to be maybe racial differences, it will be harder to melt in than it is here. I mean,
well, you know, I'm an IT guy. I've been a software developer all my adult life. I've been a county commissioner for 4 years, but for 30 years I've been in software. And in the high-tech software arena, there are all sorts of people from different nations, whether Indian or Vietnamese. And most of those folks that I know in that arena, they are proud to be an American. And some of those people, this one girl in particular, she was a boat person from Vietnam. Her dad was building the boat on the banks of the river, and he would sink it every night, or sink it during the day when the guards were around. He would raise it at night and build on it and then sink it again with boulders, and did that for week after week. This girl and her brother and her mom escaped, and her dad was left behind because he didn't have the ability to get on the boat and make their way. Today, she's an American, she's a software developer, and she is living the dream that comes with this idea. And think about the thousands of others who are trying to escape to the shores of America because of the idea we represent about freedom.
Yes, and a few of them are going to be a little bit disappointed because we've kind of lost a lot of those freedoms, but it's still, as you rate it among other countries, there are still very few countries that have, I would say, a better offer than we have. Although we used to be number one, and now I don't know if we're in the top 20 anymore. But still, out of 180 nations, that's a lot. That's pretty good.
Yeah. Well, in today's discussion, it would be a fraud to talk about the American government of today and the political culture of today and talk about it like it is what the constitutional constraints that were imposed are designed to look like, because what we see today isn't how it was designed. So it's important for your listeners to always go back to the founders' originating ideas. What were these men thinking? What you know, sparked the thought in their mind? What caused them to write what they wrote? What are the ideas that are driving this American landscape versus the conglomeration of prejudice and monetary gain that we're seeing coming out of the cronyism that is developed in today's legislature? That's not the way the system was designed. And when I talk about the beauty of the American Republic, I'm talking about the original design, not the disaster that we have today, because the nuts and bolts of what goes on in Washington today, even in our own state capital of Salem, Oregon, that is a tragedy compared to what the goal was, and these men highlighted that goal quite clearly.
Yeah, and one of the things you said when you first started this last part here about this being a fraud from what was originally put in play is exactly the truth. And it's once there was a crack in the dam, it's become an ever-widening hole, and it's just getting and the freedom is behind that dam, and more of it's running out every day. And that's it's going to take a lot to put that stuff back behind the dam. It takes a lot of work to do that. And the original way that this was set up was to prevent exactly the type of system, economic system, government system that we have now. They fought a revolution to free themselves from this kind of government that was being imposed on them from England. And it's kind of ironic that that we've surrendered without a shot to the present condition.
Yeah, and the important facet to that is the idea of limited government. Today, if you were to ask a high school student what's government comprised of, he would say there are three branches: the legislature, the judicial, and the executive branch. And he might even be smart enough to know that the legislature is broke into bicameral legislation, where there's a House over here and a Senate over there. And then you ask him, well, why the House and why the Senate? They all get voted on in the same fashion. They all get voted on by the population of a given state. And he may recognize, you know, a little bit of a difference, the entire state versus just a certain district within the state for the House of Representatives. But that's not even the way that was designed. It was originally designed in front of the passage of the 17th Amendment in 1913. It was designed so that the state legislature would pursue their own state interest. And their own state interest would allow them to frustrate the activity of the federal bureaucrats and maintain local intimacy with the population and do what the locals wanted, not what the feds wanted. So you know, the 17th Amendment is a real tragedy. And the worst part of it is, in today's environment, people don't recognize how different it was designed, with limited government and limited power and limited jurisdictional responsibility.
Exactly. And I even remember I was listening to Thomas Woods give a speech on this, and he was giving an example of a senator who was actually recalled by his legislature. They just took him out of office in the middle of his term because he had gone along with a lobbyist and done something that was against the best interests of the state, and the legislature just removed him.
Actually, that should have happened with Obamacare. Look at all of these states being, you know, hurtled into this this federal legislation that is, frankly, unconstitutional, and states like our two senators are voting along for it, and yet all of the people in our state are getting punished by their actions. We should have yanked them out of office and replaced them with someone who would pursue our true interests. And it's a tragedy to think that that we don't have that power anymore. Here's another thought for you. Ken Ivory of the American Lands Council has a wonderful graphic where he shows the three branches of the federal government, and then he shows those same three branches in all the 50 Republican states, and he shows that on a teeter-totter, all of those 50, diverse legislative, executive, and judiciary bodies would clearly outweigh the federal body. And today we have it the other way around. On his graph, your users will appreciate this. He calls it Java the Fed, where the Fed is eating up all of the little respective jurisdictions of all the various states. We see that with the EPA. Just yesterday, the EPA swallowed Klamath, Lane, Lake, and Deschutes County with the declaring the spotted frog as an endangered species, even though it's the Oregon spotted frog, quote unquote. It's a species that lives only in Oregon and should be managed by Oregon and is really only in four counties in the state of Oregon. It is being mandated by the federal government and some guy in shiny shoes on the in the marble halls of Washington, D.C.
Yeah, that's it's a bureaucratic dictatorship.
Yes.
Yeah. I want to get back more to the to these founding fathers. They're founders of our country. Were really very bright, educated men. They're different than any revolutionaries before or since, in that they had a lot to lose. They weren't poor people. They were men of property. Some of them were wealthier than others. One of them was a smuggler. Made a fortune. John Hancock made a fortune smuggling stuff into this country. And that just kind of like a black market guy. Think of him like a modern. Oh, it's a past version of what's going on today. Maybe the people smuggling drugs and things like that. Only he was not violent. He was still running from the British inspectors and their ships all the time. He had a fast ship and he could get all that. But most of the people that were there that were signers of this declaration were people that owned property. They owned farms, maybe some quite large farms, some of them smaller. They were professional people. They had a lot to lose, and they were pretty well educated. And it's they're quite a bit different than. You say that our image of a revolutionary today being someone that comes out of the jungle with a machete between his teeth and some swath of bullets around his chest and carrying a gun on his back or something like this. They weren't that kind of revolutionaries. They're more revolutionaries of thought and mind, and they got a lot. They got people to go along with them because they were able to convince them the superiority of their ideas.
Right, and that's what makes this topic so relevant. The United States was created, and what makes it different is it's not just a boundary of these are the contiguous, lower 48 or this is the United States. It's not a boundary, it's an idea. And the idea is that governments have been created to secure our rights, and to a government can only exist from the consent of the governed. Those two notions are unique to every other nation on planet Earth, and that's the beauty of this idea we call America.
And now, my research that I was doing prior to this show, I was looking at what were some of the writers and philosophers that maybe had influence on our founders, on Jefferson and Franklin and Madison, Patrick Henry, people like this. What kinds of intellectual thinking was coming across the ocean in the form of books they were able to read and publications and had influence on their thinking that caused them to all of a sudden have this tremendous yearning to be free? And I came up with there were probably three. One of them is actually technically four sources. The first one is a guy named Algernon Sidney. I don't know if you are aware of him. He's not a commonly put out name in history, but he was actually pretty much a hardcore, I'd say he's pretty close to an anarchist, though he did believe in some government. But he was pretty hardcore. He wasn't afraid of the threats from the crown about the things that he was writing about. And eventually the crown imprisoned him and put him to death. That would be the king, by when I say the crown. One of the things that he said that really stirred me was this kind of like a Braveheart speech. This was his death speech before he was put to death. He says, God has left nations the liberty of setting up such governments as best please themselves. He thanked God that he had now become a witness to the truth and to the old cause of liberty against tyranny. And he said, quote, this is an age which makes truth pass for treason. And that kind of reminded me of Ron Paul's quote that he made in his first run at president 2008, the truth is treason in the empire of lies. And I said, wow, that's saying the same thing. And so I was pretty impressed with that. Before when I read this was before I had heard Ron Paul's quote, so it didn't resonate with me quite so much. That was kind of cool. He was killed in 1683. He was a contemporary of John Locke, who was also very instrumental in the intellectual growth of our founders. John Locke was a lot more timid in his writing. He didn't want to be put to death. And so he would write out the stuff he wanted to say, and then he'd write stuff that kind of conflicted it or was contradictory to it, so he wouldn't get in trouble. But I really think that he was really truly libertarian in his thinking and wanted to be free. And this is one of the things he said in defending revolution. He says, "Those who oppose the right to revolution as turbulent and destructive may as well say, upon the same ground, that honest men may not oppose robbers or pirates because this may occasion disorder or bloodshed. If any mischief come in such causes, it is not to be charged upon him who defends his own right, but on him who invades his neighbors." I think that's just, I don't think anybody can disagree with that. Anybody, any American living today can disagree with that sentiment. I mean, that's just truth. The third person was really two people. It was two authors, and they were very cautious about what they were, not so much what they were writing, but who they were. They were kind of writing incognito. They made their publications were called Cato's Letters. And these guys were the ones that are the most often cited references to advancing the cause of liberty throughout the colonies. And I think that was mainly because they wrote in a style that was easier for people to understand. It wasn't just the size of the words they used, but they wrote shorter sentences and only stuck on one subject at a time, and then would go on the next one to be another subject. So they were really trying to advance something just bit by bit by bit, and the people kind of slowly put it together themselves. Here's some great quotes from some of their writings. "Liberty is the divine source of all human happiness. A power to do good can never become a warrant for doing evil. Only checks upon the magistrates make nations free, and only the want of such checks makes them slaves. Tyrants reduce mankind to brutes and make the reason which God gives them useless to them." So, anyway, John Trenchard, Thomas Gordon, they were the people that were the authors of Cato Letters, and they also, I believe that these two guys were the guys that did this. I was trying to find this before the show, and I couldn't find the confirmation of it, but I believe they were also sending over a lot of other material that was, and they were having it placed in the various colleges, mostly in the New England area, that were written by philosophers who are more libertarian in nature, so they were kind of seeding the universities with the, I would say, a positive propaganda for liberty. And those, if any of you out there want to really know how our nation came about, you could do worse than to go and to research these three sources for the wisdom that was in the words that they were writing. And look at what they were saying, and then you can look at things like the Declaration of Independence, and the words just jump out of they jump off the page at you because they're so similar to what these guys were saying. You can see they had a tremendous influence on Jefferson, for sure. Patrick Henry, for sure. I think that he got a lot of the things that he was saying from the Cato Letters. People attributed his success as being able to speak to the common man, and I think that was because he realized the power of the stuff that was coming from Cato Letters. So that is one of the things I wanted to pass on to everybody in the show today, is to let them know that this stuff didn't just happen in a vacuum. These guys weren't just sitting around one day thinking, "Oh, I think we should be free." This is something that happened over hundreds of years, probably. It maybe went back. These people were probably influenced by maybe the Spanish Scholastics. And it just kind of, the truth gets out there, and it never, once it's been said, it's never quiet. It's always there. And people rediscover it generation after generation. And it doesn't matter when they wrote it. It's still the truth. So,
right. And Trenchard in the Independent Whig, which is in the same time frame as Cato's letters,
yes,
was writing mostly about religious matters in relation of the church and the state. And these ideas fold together in a real important way, because he says in there, all men are born free. Liberty is a gift from which they receive from God, and no one can alienate it by consent, though possibly they may forfeit it through crimes. In other words, he's pointing out that idea of inalienable rights again. And he's talking about government doesn't give you these things, although you may forfeit them like a criminal does when he's behind bars. He doesn't have the right to go down and buy a hamburger. And you and I enjoy that freedom on a daily basis. And that forfeiture is entirely different than where do the rights come from and how do they originate and how are they supported and how are they maintained. And these are important ideas just to have your listeners get their minds around and recognize, how all of these things work together to create, this thing you and I are calling an idea. And then I'll point readers to another. This is a quote from John Adams, and it was rather late. It was in the year 1815. But nevertheless, he makes a point about the revolution. You started this conversation by saying these men were propertied men. They had property. They were going to lose their lives and their liberty, their sacred honor, and their fortunes. That's how they close their Declaration of Independence, is saying we are willing, to put all of this on the line. And then John Adams makes the comment, what do we mean by revolution? The war? No, that was no part of the revolution. It was only an effect and a consequence. The revolution, he continues, the revolution was in the mind of people, and this was effected from the year 1760 to 1775. In the course of 15 years before a drop of blood was ever shed at Lexington, that's where this idea for a new form of government was birthed. It's a fabulous example of this concept of America as an idea.
It is, and that's, I don't have much more to add to that. Just it's an amazing, it's amazing, you do all your research, and then something like that would have been something I would have loved to have come across today when I was reading, but I was in the wrong time frame. I was in the wrong century looking at stuff. And that was he had it exactly right. The revolution was in the minds of men, and it's probably been going on for quite a while. I mean, there was the Dark Ages were dark because of the tyranny, the feudal system, the serfdom, and all that. It wasn't in the lack of freedom. Then the Renaissance began to change all that, and that was also a revolution in people's minds, that the information and knowledge should be accessible to everybody. And that was kind of brought on by the printing press, I guess. That's always been my idea. Anyway, I don't want to get off track too much. We want to talk about America, not Europe. One more story I thought of, and this is, I talked a little bit about this to Colby before the show. My biological father, he died shortly before I was born. He contracted encephalitis, and he was just unlucky, I guess. He waited too long to go to the hospital. It's something that should have been a curable disease, but it's when you're messing around with the brain, you got a little too much pressure on the brain, it just was not meant to be. And I was still in the womb when that happened, so I never knew him. And my mother would make, as I grew up, she would occasionally make pilgrimages up to Astoria from Medford so that I could meet my father's side of the family. And my grandmother was She had immigrated here from Finland, and she never, in her whole life, never spoke a word of English. And it's like maybe hi, thank you, or something like that. And even then, you could hardly recognize what she was saying. And I never considered her anything but an American.
It's
not about language and culture and customs. She wanted to come here for the dream.
Yeah, that's a fabulous story, because she never could speak the primary language English, but she considered herself an American. That's fabulous.
Yeah, and it's I still remember the first time she saw me. I think it was about 7 years old, 6 or 7 years old, and she was just saying all this stuff. I didn't understand a word she was saying, but she was smiling a lot. And she went back in her bedroom and she brought out a little silk coin purse, and she got out some change, so I could go, when I went to the store, I could buy some candy or something. And she was just so pleased. And I looked so much like my father did at the same age. And she was very excited to see me. And then we would go up every 2 or 3 years, we'd go up again. And she never, ever could say anything to me in English, but it was always a joyous time. So, yeah, that's what America is. It's people from all over the world have come here to be a part of a dream.
Yeah, and actually that's language that I didn't ever consider before. But think of the whole notion of the American dream. That dreams are, talk about, you know, ideas. Dreams are these vague ideas. They're these goals. They're aspirations. They're hopes. They're, you know, these things, we call them dreams about the future and where you want to be and where you want to live and what you want to do and what career path you'll take. All of these sorts of things are all, they're all taking place within the within our minds, within the realm of our thought life. They're not taking place in the physical world, and so this is fundamentally a super important concept for us to get a handle on. America isn't about the constable, the sheriff's office, the courthouse, the local county supervisors or county commissioners or parish commissioners. America is about this idea of individual liberty and individual freedom. And the collectivist worldview that is being propagandized through the bureaucracies is really kind of anti-constitutional, because it tries to put everybody under the same weight of jurisdiction, so that everybody is required to carry health care. Like the three of us, we got three males here on this phone call, and all of us are required to carry maternity care. It's one of the essential elements that's required under the Obamacare health plan. And regardless of our ages, we're required to care, medical care for a pediatrician. And it's like, you know what, my kids are 30, they're married, they've been out of the house for a number of years, and they may need that, but Diane and I certainly don't, and yet that's an essential element of today's healthcare legislation, because they're trying to make everybody look equal, and none of us are. None of us are equal in our face, our form, our stature, our height, our weight, our shoe size. We are all different. We carry different talents and different experiences in our heart and soul. We have different knowledge base. We have different preferences and likes and dislikes. And to put us all in the same skillet and try and fry us up in the same fashion just won't work.
Nope. And it's not like they don't have a blueprint out there. You know, when has central planning ever worked? You know, can you ever point to a time when central planning provided the best answer for anything? It never does. It's always comes up wanting. Because no matter how smart the people are that are doing the planning, they just can't know everything they need to know to make the right decision for every individual.
Right.
So, well, they have to make blanket decisions, and you have all these crazy outcomes like this.
Yeah, and you know, I recommend people read F.A. Hayek's book, The Fatal Conceit, where he talks about the conceit of the central planner is that he could possibly know all of those details, that he could organize all of the ins and outs to make it work for everybody. And the truth is, if you know, planners probably do the plan okay for a small population, but there's millions and millions that the plan doesn't work for. And the small population, more and more in modern America, is becoming a limited set of those with money. My recent campaign for the U.S. House here in Oregon is an example of that, where that limited scope has got enormous economic resources to throw at getting their man in office. And that just means all of the other moms and pops up and down Main Street and in your neighborhood are left high and dry, and they're going to carry the burden. The federal deficit is now $18 trillion, and that doesn't even account for the nearly $5 trillion that the Federal Reserve has new on their balance sheet. And it's all a big money machine, as long as they can buy votes and put this on future generations.
I don't think it covers all the off-budget stuff either, and it certainly doesn't cover any of the future liabilities.
Oh yeah, the unfunded. Oh, actually, the actuarially accrued unfunded liabilities are. You can look it up on Bloomberg. Put in the number 222 and the word trillion. And maybe the word unfunded or whatever, and you'll get the article from 2 years ago that said the unfunded actuarially accrued liabilities of the United States were $222 trillion. And when you know, that ought to make everybody's head swim, and that means those are promises.
The whole world couldn't repay.
The whole world isn't even worth that much.
Yes.
You know, so... So if aliens came to planet Earth and wanted to do a fair trade, you know, we couldn't even, you know, trade. We couldn't even sell the entire planet, all the people, all the material, all the machines and men and mines and forests and fisheries. We couldn't sell all of it for that amount of money.
Yeah, and I got to imagine that if our founders could know that knowledge, they would be spinning like a gyroscope in their grave. I mean, this is exact opposite of what they wanted. This is what they risked their lives, their fortunes, their sacred honor for, is to get us away from that kind of a system, get us away from this. It's actually a form of mercantilism. It's similar to it, but it was a little bit more probably closer to fascism, but it's patterned after mercantilism.
It's clearly fascism. You know, it's actually a big... If you or I did this on any street corner, you or I would be in jail, because what essentially is going on is we're borrowing money to buy goods for today. So let's just break this down for your listeners. Let's say we want to borrow $1 trillion. If you or I did that in today's marketplace, we'd buy $1 trillion, and then we would have to work hard enough to not only earn back the trillion and pay back the principal, but we'd also have to earn extra enough to pay the interest on that $1 trillion. And so it's not free money, because I have to pay it back, and I've got to pay back the interest as well as the principal. So what do we do in America? We deficit spend, and we put it not on our backs. So we get the benefit today. We get the $1 trillion loan today, and we say we'll pay you back in the future. That means some other generation, some your children, your grandchildren, maybe your great-grandchildren, will be the ones who are obligated to pay that back. And so you and I have scooped all of the cake and the ice cream and the cookies, and we've pushed the bill off into the future. And not only do they have to raise that $1 trillion in the future, they've got to raise the interest payments to all of the borrowers in the future. And there's not going to be enough for them ever to get an old stale potato chip, let alone the cake, cookies, and ice cream that you and I are downing today.
Yeah, it's generational theft. And just because the people still get paid doesn't mean that what they're getting paid in is going to be able to buy anything. Already, just in my lifetime, the value of my labor has been about 50% of the value of my labor has been stolen by this kind of action. Because they're just keep increasing the debt, printing more money, borrowing more money. It's just what has happened is I used to work, before I went to college, I worked in the orchards around here during the summers, thinning pears, and we would make about $1 an hour. I don't remember exactly what it was. I think it was $1.10 a tree. But on that dollar an hour, if I got paid in silver dimes, I could fill up my gas tank on about, it was about 2 hours worth of work. I had a Volkswagen, had a 10-gallon tank. Gas was 25 cents a gallon, so it was $2.50, about 2.5 hours. Today, a minimum wage laborer doing the same, and that, by the way, that's what that kind of job was, a minimum wage job. A minimum wage laborer is getting close to $10 an hour, but I doubt he could fill up a 10-gallon tank on 2.5 hours worth of work, because $25 isn't going to fill up a 10-gallon tank. Gasoline's $4 a gallon, so the labor's still the same, but what it'll buy has been, and actually the price of gasoline has gone down. If you measure it in silver dimes, you can buy more gasoline with silver dimes today than you could then, and that's what we would expect technology has made production better, so the price of commodities is going down a little bit as productive capacities increased and get more efficient, but at the same time, the value of your labor is going down because of the monetary policies, the debt, all this is going on. This is it's generational theft. It's happened just in my lifetime, and I when I first discovered this, I was just shocked. I was mad for about a week, but it's not much I can do about it except. Find ways to protect what wealth I do have, and that's what I try and do. But this is exactly the opposite of what our founders wanted. They wanted to have, money was supposed to be gold and silver, and now it's paper.
And soon it'll be credit, or actually it'll be online. But I mean, this is something we're going to see continue, and we know that. I think the biggest flaw we have nowadays is that it's a top-down, more military-style government than it should have been when the people were in charge to begin with. If you keep the people in charge as they're supposed to be, as the representatives of themselves with their liberties, it's not as big of a deal. But when you have a ruling class of people that really don't interact with everyone that's, not as well off as they are or things like that, they just kind of stay in their own little groups like people do normally. And then you get them writing the rules, and then everything just comes from the top down. And you've got the largest army in the world, so guess what? You're not going to rebel against them, because force will be used against you. It's a continuing pattern of downward spiral.
You can rebel in other ways, Colby. You just gotta don't consent.
I think there's lots of us that are doing that. I was talking about rebel as in militarily rebel.
Actually, when you try and use force, you usually get the opposite result you're looking for. So that's kind of a last resort just to defend yourself. But I think there's other ways to root out this problem without using force. At least that's my hope.
The pen is always my dear.
Seems to be. Algernon Sidney, he didn't get put to death because he was raising a sword against the king. It was because of what he was writing, because the king realized that was a lot more dangerous than brandishing a sword. Yeah, so
I think the important thing to recognize about the concept of indebtedness, the federal spending and whatnot, is that this money is being used today to propagandize the collective perspective and to ensure that the bureaucracies continue. Let's in our county over the past couple of days, the Sky Lakes Wilderness area, the fire is known as the 790 fire, and that fire is close to 2,200 acres and has been pouring smoke into our area. It's, quote, a wilderness area, which requires a bureaucracy to manage and make sure everything's okay. Because it's a wilderness area, you can't put a motor vehicle in there to put the fire out. So no truck can haul men and machines and shovels and fire extinguishers, let alone water tankers or tenders. What we have to do is load up a, quote, mule team, and seriously, I'm talking mules, and put mule teams and shovels and saddle packs and march the mules on the wilderness trail. And it was 200 acres. Today it's 2,200 acres because we will not fight it with the technology and wisdom that God has blessed us with. This is a bureaucratic nightmare, and then they're going to manage the land for us and replant the land for us and tell us we can't salvage those logs because our equipment would harm the landscape. But the landscape has been essentially sterilized. The watersheds have been polluted with all the ash and poison. The wild animals, the habitat, the streams and fisheries that exist in the Sky Lakes area have all been devastated. And we're doing this with a bureaucracy that, quite frankly, doesn't care. They don't take any concern over the loss of these assets because it's just their job to manage the asset. Whether the asset is smoking or blue sky beautiful, they don't care. They just get to manage the asset. The bureaucracy funds all of the environmental groups that review the policy. It funds the academic elites that are looking at how should we manage this land in a collective sense. And the true solution would be to utilize the land for its best purpose. And the only way to determine best in that perspective is through economic value. What is the land worth? What does it? What can it provide? What beauty can it provide, as well as what value can it provide? And why aren't we harvesting that lumber before it all burns up? The timber that's in those stands is full of ingrowth and overgrowth and fuel abundance and should have been thinned over the past years, but you can't, quote, it's a wilderness area, and we're going to let the wild burn it to a crisp instead of managing it with common sense. So this is how our federal dollars get spent, and there's no stopping a bureaucracy like this. How do you get the handle on all of these men and women who have a job to do?
You really don't. It's they get paid no matter what the outcome is. All their decisions become political decisions. They just have to make sure they don't disturb the person above them on the pay grade, whatever, the person that's their supervisor or whoever's passing the policy down the line. And all the decisions are made are have to go along those political lines. They are beholden to the, you know, to environmental groups like the I'm not going to pick on any environmental groups. I think they mean well. They don't do very well. That's the problem. But they're beholden to them as like a thousand friends of the earth or whatever they're called in the Audubon Society and however many of them there are. But they end up making these political decisions. They have no economic consequence to whatever they decide. They don't feel any of the pain that they inflict on any other people. It's always borne by people who are innocents, who are people who have no vote in the outcome of the decision. We are basically slaves to this bureaucracy that's unelected, and we don't even know what their faces look like. We don't have a name. There's just this is horrible, and some of you that live in other parts of the United States, especially east of the Mississippi, you get the benefit of your state's getting to own most of its own land. Out here, we own less than 50% of the land in our counties. It's public land. The federal government doesn't really own it, but they have assumed control over it.
They call that jurisdictional ownership.
Yeah, and it's really a cruel authoritarian system, and it's exactly what was behind the Bundy Ranch problem. We talked about this on the show last time you were on, Dennis. We lost billions of dollars worth of timber every summer.
Yeah,
With a B, billions.
I had a firsthand example of this when I was out hiking last weekend, and I went off 140 more towards Dennis's area, and right there by Lake of the Woods, off to the left, though, instead, and there's a ski trail, and we were hiking back and looking for signs of bear and stuff like that, and just walking through there, man, hundreds upon hundreds of trees that have just been sitting there rotting out forever, that if we would have had maintenance over this, we could have gone in, taken some of them out, left some for foraging animals and things like that, that want the grubs and want the mushrooms and everything else that's going to grow off those fallen trees. But we've left so much fuel for these fires that I was looking and I was like, there's no way. If I dropped a cigarette right now, I'd have to run for my life.
That's exactly true. This is one of the drought on the whole West Coast. This is one of the, it's been very little rain the last three summers and a lot of thunderstorms and electrical, you know, lightning starting fires, and they can't put them all out, and it just takes one of them to get started, and there's not, once they get going, there's not much can start stop it, especially if it's in a wilderness area.
Well, yeah, the mule team is a hard train to get up into the mountains. In Oregon, 54% of the state is owned by Oregon and Oregon private citizens, Oregon commercial and industrial. The rest of that, so the other 56% is owned by the federal government.
Yeah, and it's like kind of a technicality because it probably still belongs to the state. We just haven't claimed it, and so they assume control over it and management of it, and they are a horrible manager of this resource. If you guys think of your listener out there, and if you had a company and someone made a decision that caused $2 billion worth of your assets to just disappear, I mean, would you let that guy still keep working and making decisions? No, of course you wouldn't. You'd fire him. They're costing you $2 billion. But it's a political decision, not an economic one, so they don't care.
Right. Let me tell your listeners, if they're interested in looking some of this stuff up, go to AmericanLandsCouncil.org. And at the American Lands Council, they can see an initiative that our county commission is sponsoring, along with a whole slew of the 11 western states that are trying to secure the transfer of public lands. The last time the transfer of public lands took place actually took place in 1959, so it wasn't that long ago that the federal government transferred all federal public lands to a state. It happened to take place and coincide with the statehood of Hawaii, and it happened in Hawaii. But nevertheless, you'll hear as you talk to people that this can't be done. Oh, you're just, you know, dreaming wild dreams that will never come to fruition.
But it's been done in my lifetime.
It's happened in our lifetime.
Yeah. Well, we're getting close to the end of our show. We're going to hear music pretty soon. Dennis, I want to thank you so much for being on today. We're hoping if Dennis's schedule permits that he's going to be a regular guest on the last Thursday of every month. If he has other things that come up, well, that's how it goes. But if he's able to and he's willing to keep coming on, we really delight in having him on. He's just a wealth of information. He's a really interesting guy.
Let me close with one more quote. This is from Sam Adams. He was writing to his wife, and he says, "I am now," and this is for everybody, you, me, Colby, and your listeners, "I am now more convinced of anything that it is my duty," capital D on duty, "my duty to oppose to the utmost of my ability the designs of those who would enslave my country. And with God's assistance, I'm resolved to appease them.